It's 12 o'clock. Time for the news read by Jane Royce.
A Home Office minister said he doesn't accept Dr. Dan Poulter's criticism of the government's record on the NHS after the Tory MP defected to Labour. Dr. Poulter, who's a part-time doctor, said the Conservatives were failing the health service and he could no longer look his patients in the eye. The policing minister, Chris Philps, said the government was spending more on the NHS than at any point in its history. The leader of the ALBA party, Alex Salmond, says his MSP, Ash Regan, will meet Scotland's First Minister this week for talks which could get him out of a tight corner. Hamza Yousaf is facing two no-confidence votes after collapsing the power-sharing agreement with the Scottish Greens. The First Minister has already ruled out an electoral pact between ALBA and the SNP. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has said only the United States can stop Israel launching a ground offensive against the overcrowded city of Rafah in southern Gaza. Mr. Abbas told a global economic summit in Saudi Arabia that he expected an attack could come within days. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is also expected to attend the summit as ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas continue. The Irish government is planning legislation that would enable it to send asylum seekers back to the UK. Irish ministers estimate that 80% come to the country via Northern Ireland, which has an open border with the Irish Republic. The authorities in the Philippines have suspended state school classes for 2 days because of an extreme heat wave. The temperature in the capital, Manila, hit a record high yesterday, and the hot weather is forecast to continue for several more weeks. The authorities in Tobago say a British man who was attacked by a shark on Friday remains in a stable condition in intensive care. 64-year-old Peter Smith suffered significant wounds and had surgery to reattach some of his fingers. The Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said there's a national crisis of gender violence in the country. Addressing a rally in Canberra, Mr. Albanese called for a change of culture and the legal system. And the weather, rain continuing to ease this afternoon across many parts. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions.
Edith Hall is Professor of Classics at Durham University, and her passion for her subject reaches far beyond the lecture hall or the seminar room. She wants us all to understand how the writing and thinking of ancient Greece still influences how we write and think today. She leads a campaign called Advocating Classics Education to promote teaching in state secondary schools, and her books include Aristotle's Way, How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life, and Ancient Greeks, 10 Ways They Shaped the Modern World. Her writing and teaching are based on decades of scholarship with a focus on ancient Greek drama, and she's also a familiar voice as a broadcaster on programmes like In Our Time. Her most recent book is Facing Down the Furies, Suicide, The Ancient Greeks and Me, a deeply personal account of the psychological damage that suicide inflicts across generations, drawing parallels between her own family history and characters from Greek tragedy. Well, your music, Edith, includes Schubert, Beethoven, Gluck, but we're going to begin rather appropriately with a funeral march, aren't we?
We are, the Dead March from Handel's Saul. Now, I could have actually chosen 9 tracks from Handel very easily. He's definitely one of my very favourite composers. I play him when low. I find he always gives me a motor. And this particular melody is actually the first tune I can remember from my childhood. I was sitting on a sofa with my mother in 1965. We'd only just got a television, a small little old black and white thing, watching the funeral of Winston Churchill. And I remember singing it afterwards. I was only just 6. But I was very aware, even at the time, from my mother's response, that what I was watching was something momentous historically. and that it was some sort of strange turning point. I was aware even then, I couldn't have put it into those words, but this was the end of a whole era of Englishness and Britishness, and the lament of the music seemed to me somehow to be the lament not just for Winston Churchill at all, but for the entire generation who'd lived through the war. It felt like that, and in fact it was like that, because we're in 1965 and politics, liberation of all kinds, was for my generation, you know, a teenager in the 70s, about to take off. But the tune is just so extraordinary, the organ is extraordinary. And what I now understand is I'm very interested in sad music in major keys. I think the minor key is almost too easy, right, to make people cry. There is something about very stately, profoundly humanist music in major keys that is sad, especially C major. Then I remember watching the cortege as his coffin was passed out and watching my mother cry, this sort of triangle TV screen. And it's only recently, when I was doing research about my own great-grandfather's funeral, a very sad case of suicide where he was buried in unknown land. He could not be buried in 1912 in the Church of Scotland on Holy Land. It was played at his funeral. And when I discovered that, I went and found this very recording that we're going to hear. And it took me straight back to 1965.
You're right, it's curious to have a funeral march in the major key, isn't it? And still to achieve that level of almost portentous dignity.
It's splendid. It's magnificent and deeply mournful. I can hardly bear to listen to it. It also, you know, my father was who died last year, was an ordained priest in the Church of England. And I know my Old Testament backwards. So I do know all about Saul and Jonathan. So I can understand oratorios. This is one of the things I've really found with knowing classics, is how much better I understand a lot of 18th century culture. But it's the same with the Bible. I am forever grateful, however much I resented all those church services as a child. I'm very, very grateful to him. So that is partly for him.
We heard the Funeral March from Saul by Handel, performed by the London Early Opera, directed by Bridget Cunningham. You were born in Birmingham in 1959, Edith Hall. And if you were going to lots of services, presumably music was quite a part of your childhood.
The church music certainly was. We actually moved to Nottingham when I was three. My father got a post as a sort of part-time vicar in a central Nottingham church, but also teaching theology at Nottingham University. I much resented that my brothers could sing in the choir. I couldn't. This was a very, very sore point for me. I had a better voice than either of them. I was better at music than either of them. And I felt the full crushing weight of the Anglican patriarchy long before I knew that phrase. Okay. But I loved the music. When I became a teenager, I joined Bach choirs and did a lot of singing. Usually.
You contralto?
I was a contralto. Well, I was really a mezzo who went low. I'm now a basso profundo as I age. But I also had piano lessons, violin lessons, did grade sevens in both, and the viola, and took some singing lessons, and did music O-level. So I was very equipped, and I'm forever grateful, even though I never play and I never sing and haven't done for 40 years. I was better at ancient Greek, and I want to be very, very good at something. But that has enabled me to understand what's going on in music much better, and I'm forever grateful.
And where did you get your first introduction to Greek mythology?
Well, my father taught me my first Greek, the very first sentence of St. John's Gospel. It's the first sentence I construed. In beginning, there is no definite article, in beginning there was the word, but it was doing Greek O-level that I started reading Greek tragedy. And I fell hard and fast. I really didn't like Latin. All we read was Julius Caesar's wars, like then I killed a lot more Belgians or whatever. Greek tragedy, the myths just resonated for me so fast, these disturbed nuclear families.
Now let's have some more music. Tell me about the next one.
This has been a very important song for me. It's called Imanamouelas, which is my mother, Greece. The reason it's important is it's from the much under-comprehended medium of rebetika, which is Greek blues. This is an indigenous Eastern Greek Anatolian tradition from when the Greeks, before the 1922 ghastly exchange of populations, as it's called, which included genocide and most terrible things, Greeks had to leave their ancestral homelands where they had been for nearly 3,000 years. Around the Black Sea and all down the western seaboard of Turkey. And they had a tradition already called the rebetika of heavy bouzouki music with blues with a very, what sounds to our ears, in inverted commas, oriental sound. There are quarter tones and incredible dirges. Now, this particular one is a very old lament, My Mother Greece, the lies that you put into me with my first milk. I do not have a house. I do not have a corner. I do not have anywhere to walk on the 1st of May. I'm sorry, I do get quite emotional about this because it's about the whole history of enforced migration. But they developed this extraordinary sound with big, big orchestras of bouzoukis and zithers and different Turkish style instruments and sang their loss of their homeland. And I first heard it around 1970, knowing there was this terrible dictatorship in Greece, because I'd got political by then. And I became a committed Philhellene, learnt the language. Hardly any classicists do that. They actually have tended to look down on Greeks today and think it's a fallen civilization. Quite the opposite.
Δεν έχω δρόμο ούτε γειτονιά να περπατήσω μια πρωτομαγιά. Τα ψεύτικα τα λόγια τα μεγάλα μου τα πες με το πρώτο σου το γάλα. Μα τώρα που ξυπνήσανε τα φίδια, εσύ φοράς τα αρχαία σου στολίδια και δεν τα κρίζεις ποτέ σου, μάνα μου ελάς, που τα παιδιά στους σκλάβους ξεπουλάς. Και δεν δακρύζεις ποτέ σου, μάνα μου ελάς, που τα παιδιά σου σκλάβους ξεπουλάς. Στην μοίρα μου μιλούσα, είχες δει τα αρχαία σου τα λούσα και στο φασάρι με πήρες γύφτησα μαϊμού. Ελλάδα, Ελλάδα, μάνα του καημού, και στο φασάρι με πήρες γύφτησα μαϊμού. Ελλάδα, Ελλάδα, μάνα του καημού.
So tell us who we were actually listening to there.
You were listening to the great George Dallaras, my view, one of the greatest tenors who has ever lived. He can sing anything. He happens to be the greatest exponent alive of Rebetika. He is an absolute national hero in Greece, and he ought to be better known. I find his control there, because accelerating is part of Greek tradition. I'm afraid you can hear it in Zorba the Greek and things like that. Yeah. But the control of it there. So it builds up from total grief to an edge of defiance. There's a defiant edge there. You know, it goes the emotional journey with this very, very almost imperceptible acceleration.
Into a dance almost.
Yes.
So it was arranged from a traditional tune.
Yes, Stavros Xarchakos is the chief, and he is too still alive. These guys are all in their high old age, and they were all out there on the barricades during the dictatorship. That arrangement, there was a movie just called Rebetiko, which I advise everybody go and find on YouTube. Historic movie, which collected the songs, and this was number one, his orchestration, because this is the lament of the Greeks. And he learnt his orchestration directly from the great Leonard Bernstein.
That's fascinating. He was such a great teacher. Edith Hall, you won a scholarship to Oxford to study classics and modern languages. When did you decide that classics was the academic route that you wanted to follow?
Not until 2 years after I graduated. I wasn't particularly happy as an undergraduate. I didn't fit in.
at Oxford. I was down working class districts in political agitation groups. And I left and burnt all my essays. I hadn't understood the way classics was taught at Oxford. I didn't get it. It didn't contextualise the literature in anything real. I was good at it, but I hadn't got my heart in it. And I went off and I tried working in business, utterly failed, left to work for the miners for a year during the Great Strike in 1984. And during that process, realised with the help of a very, very great and wonderful mentor, a senior academic called Margot Heinemann, who changed my life because she just got me in and said, what are you going to do with you, Edith? What are we going to do with you? You cry all the time. You can't be in politics. You know, you're a posh vicar's daughter. You can't lead political causes. You've got a brain, girl, she said. I remember saying, you've got a brain. Just go and do it through academia. So I said, OK. And then I thought, because most of the time, this is the 1980s, most of the time I was camped out outside the South African embassy. That was my really big cause at that time. I could not stand apartheid ever since 1968. And I saw those victors on the rostrum in the Olympics. I was fired up. So I decided to do a doctorate on ethnic stereotypes in Greek tragedies so I could somehow make sense of, blend these two things.
You recently co-authored a book called A People's History of Classics, 1689 to 1939, looking at the access to a classical education during that time. And it was very class-based, wasn't it?
It was. I have to say that was co-authored with the amazing Dr. Henry Stead at St. Andrews University. I decided that one way to combat the elitist reputation of classics was to excavate its progressive past so that we've got two sets of portraits to hang on the wall. And I discovered over 25 years of archival research the amount that workers' libraries used the Greeks and Romans. The difference is they did not do it in Greek and Latin. They read voluminous amounts of classics in English in workers' libraries from the mid-18th century. And the ancient Greeks and Romans have fired up trade unionists. They've fired up suffrage campaigns. They fired up women's suffrage. It has a glorious past as well as a Etonian past. So that book is an attempt to say, look, there is another whole way of using this material, and that is to change the world for good.
Your passion for freedom and equality is rather nicely demonstrated in your next choice of music.
Well, this is really the melody of my teens and 20s, having realised that there is this country in the world where people are still actually completely oppressed and excluded from everything because they have slightly more melanin in their skin than some of the others. And this particular recording is from the end of the movie Cry Freedom, which was the Richard Attenborough movie about Steve Biko, played absolutely brilliantly by the young Denzel Washington. And the last few minutes, it has this incredible chorus of this old anthem. It was actually written by a black Methodist in the late 19th century, Enoch Sontonga, and it was the ANC's anthem. But as the credits rolled to Cry Freedom, we have this extraordinary mass, women and men, choir, singing. And as the credits roll, they have the name of all the young men who died in custody and been given no decent explanation. They hadn't even been sentenced to death. And they roll past this tragedy going on that you're reading, including Biko, to this music that gets louder and louder and ever more rousing. And it's just so beautiful. It is the best anthem in the world. And I will not be able to listen to it now without crying.
Oh,
Now, I played that really loud as Nelson Mandela walked out of prison.
We heard Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, performed by Ture Domakude. The original hymn came from a schoolteacher called Enoch Sontonga in 1897, but was then adapted for the 1987 film Cry Freedom, which was scored by George Fenton and Jonas Gwangwa. You, Edith Hall, are absolutely passionate about people learning classics and ancient languages. So what do you say to them when they say, aren't these dead languages?
I say to them that the inside of their minds is the shape it is because of the ancient Greeks. Everything about our minds, our emotions, our myths, our stories. There is no subject that you can study where it wasn't invented in ancient Greece, except for some very, very advanced technologies and possibly, arguably, philosophy of the mind. Absolutely everything else. Why are they called ology, ography? Because they were invented by the ancient Greeks. They invented every literary form and medium that we've got, from love songs to theatre scripts to dialogues, biography, historiography. And if we don't know where we came from culturally, this is only 3 millennia ago, then we have no idea who we really are or where we can go.
You are a big fan, and I salute you for this, of Aristotle, and written a book called Aristotle's Way, How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life. It's a sort of self-help guide, isn't it?
The book, I hope, is. I hope it does help people. I was a very depressed and unhappy young woman. I lost my faith, which had been extremely intense. I was very pious until I was 13. And I lost it all. And I spent 7 years in an emotional and psychic wilderness because I couldn't see a single good reason for trying to be a good person if there was no providential deity, no punishment, and no life after death. And I'm afraid we're living under an advanced form of very brutal capitalism where the nice guys finish last. And in fact, I started reading Aristotle's Ethics at university and I could not believe my eyes. Here was a man arguing patiently why, if you try to be the best possible version of yourself, work on your virtues, you will be happier. There is something in it for you. And it's not just that if you're nice to other people, they will be nice back. That is part of it. It is that you simply have a battery coming from within you, that even if you're suffering the worst kind of persecution, you know you have done your best with your one chance on the planet. It's a complicated ethics, but I tried to write a book how it could be put into action by another middle-aged woman. But it's massively helped me, in particular because all the other ancient secular philosophical systems, and there were 5, Platonism, Cynicism, Stoicism, and so on, see a duality between body and mind. And they think bodies are basically bad. Sex is bad. Sensations are bad. Eating is bad. They're austere. Aristotle says, absolutely not. It's a sliding scale. Emotions, passions, and instincts are all great, but we don't want them in total excess and out of control. So me, as a very passionate person who'd been brought up as a little Christian girl, that any sort of lusts, desires, appetites or extremes of emotion were just bad and have to be oppressed. This was just liberating in the extreme.
More music now, this time Schubert.
Yes. I am obsessed with 18th century classical music, as you're probably beginning to realise. I think it very much relates to my love of the classical form. I like the discipline of quite rigid form and don't like romantic music. So this, when I was very depressed, when I was about 30, my first marriage broke up and I saw Barry Lyndon, outstanding film. Everything about evoking visually the 18th century is incredible, the candlelight. But throughout it, we have this andante con moto. And to me, it is the walking pace of a sad person. I did play it as a teenager when I still played the fiddle. I mean, hopelessly badly with an amateur trio. But if you are depressed, get out of bed, walk this, and you will feel better by the end of your walk. Thank you.
There's everything in there, isn't there? Humour, passion, calmness.
It's a complete emotional journey. And a lot of that movie is about 7 years' war and soldiers trudging through the mud for 7 years. But also Schubert, he's dying. He dies at 31. This is one of the very last things that he wrote. I find it unbelievable that that emotional depth comes out of a 30-year-old. And that beautiful, beautiful melody that the cello starts and we come back to at the end after playing with it. That's actually, it was a Swedish folk song that Schubert had heard called Watching the Sun Go Down. And that just seems to me to get the emotions of this dying young man so perfectly.
Your latest book, Facing Down the Furies, Suicide, the Ancient Greeks and Me, links your family history to Greek tragedy. Did you sense that there was that link early on?
Yes, I think I did. The first Greek tragedy I read was Iphigenia and Aulis, which is all about how a brutal killing in a family affects them for generations, the ghosts of the past. And the Greeks have this figure, in Latin it's the Furii, the Furia, it's actually the Erinis in Greek. They're the ghosts of the unjustly or untimely dead, who haunt, who will not leave the living alone. And it's a profound metaphor for what we would now understand in more Freudian terms as transference of pain and trauma down the generations. And it completely made sense to me. And I regard my family, it's my mother's line, as having had the Furies on them for 4 or 5 generations.
It's resonance, isn't it?
Yes.
Because you show how suicide in families is often hushed up.
Yes.
But the consequences are felt across the generations, and you're a prime example of this.
I really am. My mother did not kill herself, though I think she thought about it. But my grandmother did, her mother, who was called Edith, and that didn't happen until after I was around. And her father had done it, and my mother's first cousin. It was just the solution to the pain that we all have in life for them. And the trouble is that it becomes highly imitative. There are many, many problems with it. But until the early 1970s, there was absolutely no understanding of the transgenerational impact, none. And also the taboo remained so heavy from Christianity, basically, though the other great monotheisms also proscribe it. And the silence in my family about my grandmother's death, which my mother cried every single day, right. She never got over it, but nor was she able to get any help for it. And the silence made it far, far bigger for all of us than if she had actually spoken about it. One thing I want to do with this book is get more people talking about suicide to each other. Everybody who I ever mentioned the fact that there is suicide in my family tree, practically every single person starts welling up, coming up with an aunt or an uncle or a friend or a workmate. We have to talk about it more. We have to stop it happening as much so that people don't feel as ashamed to say they have these feelings. And then if they do, we need what the suicidologists call postvention. Everybody needs desperate help. This is far worse than a normal death. It's like a murder. It's a violent death, right? And it's covered in shame. And we have got to get it out of the cupboard.
And that resonance, the harm it does to others, is something that Aristotle warned about, isn't it?
He absolutely did. He's the only ancient philosopher who said, wait a minute, who does this harm? It can't harm the person who's done it because they're dead. And he didn't really believe in an afterlife. So who does it harm? And he actually says it's the community. You're a citizen of the community. If you remove a member of the community, then you are doing damage to everybody else. So I started researching the history of the philosophers on suicide, because it became frightfully fashionable in the Enlightenment and Romantic period to have an artistically interesting self-inflicted death.
Die of a broken heart.
Or a frustrated creative genius like Chatterton. And it's not. And it's something that really needs to get out of the cupboard and onto the front burner. And being able to talk about it on Radio 3, to me, shows I'm doing something right.
Talking about your own experience, you travelled to Scotland to find out a bit more about your great-grandfather, Robert Masterton. He took his life in 1912.
Yes.
And you compare his death to Sophocles' play Ajax.
Oh, yes. Well, there's a certain type of middle-aged man's suicide when he feels he's been snubbed or humiliated outside the house. If you combine it with the cocktail of feeling extremely lonely or isolated or alienated from a wife and children, this is the demographically dangerous group
And both my great-grandfather, Robert Masterton, and Sophocles Ajax absolutely fall into that group. They both use deception, that's the other thing, to be able to get away from people who are worried about them. And Sophocles has written the play in a way that gives you all the information. Everybody says after he does it, we should have realised. He did say yesterday he wanted to kill himself. Why did we believe him when he said, go away and leave me alone? They all say this. Sophocles is educating his audience in how to spot suicidal urges in war-traumatised warriors.
Do you think there's a genetic link to feeling like this?
Yes, I think it's chromosome 7. I mean, it has been absolutely identified and repeated in numerous tests, just as endogenous depression and alcoholism, many of them have a biological ingredient.
Which means I can't avoid asking whether you've ever had suicidal thoughts.
Oh, absolutely. I nearly killed myself just before my finals. And I have thought about it at other times. Since I've had children, it is completely out of the question. I would never do that to a child after what happened to my mother. But I have what's called suicidal ideation.
And can it be, do you think, related to the kind of feelings you get with vertigo when you feel pulled towards the edge? Is that the same thing as
yes,
finding yourself
under? Yes, I can't go anywhere near edges. I'm like Winston Churchill, who suffered from exactly this because he had the black dog of despair. But he said he had to stand as far back on the tube platforms as he could because of the risk of tossing
Euripides
himself.
Helped you out of your crisis.
Oh, yes.
Tell me how that
happened. The opposite play to Ajax, exact opposite, is how to talk someone down. And it's the great hero Heracles. And in this, he is a wonderful father, a wonderful husband, the great saviour of Greece, total superhero. And he is sent deluded by his jealous stepmother. He's done nothing wrong, kills his wife and all his children. Comes round halfway through the play. Now, if you've killed your wife and all your children, the four people you love most in the world, you know, I would kill myself in that situation. His best friend, Theseus, who's been to the underworld with, and his adoptive non-biological father, his human father, Amphitryon, because he's Zeus's son, friends, I mean, they're not biologically related, spend the rest of the play talking him down. And it is a pitch-perfect, word-perfect script for using with somebody thinking about self-destruction. And I want it on, I want a director to work with, and I want to invite lots of people from the psychiatric community. It is the most precious of all the Greek tragic scripts, and yet it's hardly ever played, probably because it is about suicide.
But it's Joan Baez next.
Well, what can we do with Joan Baez's voice? I mean, she's the female George Dalaras, as far as I'm concerned. A folk background, but a great songwriter as well. You drown in her vibrato. And Diamonds and Rust is, I think, one of the greatest songs ever written about the end of a love affair. And so to me, when I was 30 years old and I'd left my first husband, with whom I'd had a very passionate and intimate and, in the early days, joyous relationship, I got into an absolutely terrible depression. You know, I did end up in mental hospital for a week. In fact, it was a bit more than a week. And this song about you were diamond, but it's turned into rust. She's talking about Bob Dylan. For me, it was about the relationship my entire adult life so far. I met that man when I was about 19.
Well, I'll be damned. Here comes your ghost again. Just that the moon is full and you happen to call. And here I sit and on the telephone, hearing a voice I'd known a couple of light years ago, heading straight for a fall. As I remember, your eyes were bluer than robin's eggs. My poetry was lousy, you said. Where are you calling from? A booth in the Midwest. 10 years ago, I bought you some cufflinks. You brought me something. Diamonds and rust. Mm-hmm. the scene already a legend, the unwashed phenomenon, the original vagabond, you strayed into my arms, and there you stayed, temporarily lost at sea, the Madonna was yours for free, yes, the girl on the half shed unharmed. Now I see you standing with brown leaves falling all around and snow in your hair. Now you're smiling out the window of that crummy hotel over Washington Square. Our breath comes out in white clouds, mingles and hangs in the air. Speaking strictly for me, we both could have died then and there. Now you're telling me you're not nostalgic. Another word for it. You were so good with words and at keeping things vague. Cause I need some of that vagueness now. It's all come back too clearly. Yes, I love you dearly. And if you're offering me diamonds and rust, I've already paid.
Diamonds and Rust, written and performed by Joan Byers. That vibrato you mention is very touching in a way, isn't it?
And I don't usually like vibrato. It just purrs out of her, it rolls like these waves of feeling and softness. I cannot get enough of that woman's voice. And I think she knows it. She's still singing.
Edith Hall, the other story in Facing Down the Furies is about your grandmother, and you were named after her.
I was.
She was something of a trailblazer.
She was. That's what makes it all the more utterly wasteful, what happened to her. So she's brought up in Dunbar. She's a very clever little girl. She's the first in the family to go off to university when very few women had ever gone to university. She goes to Edinburgh to read English and Latin, and I have her books. And she was a suffragette, and she also ended up getting an incredibly high distinction. She taught English in an Edinburgh school. But she never got over the suicide of her father before her finals, ever.
You came across her scribbles, didn't you, in the margins of texts
yes,
you had studied?
I've used her edition in George Saintsbury. That was the old textbook. And I've read through with her Aristotle's Poetics. And it makes my hair stand on end that I'm reading with her underlinings and jottings. The trouble is, though, that, you know, I think my mother did sort of hand me a script. You're so like my mother. You're difficult like her. You're miserable like her. You're clever like her. I do look like her. All my siblings were blonde. I was the dark one, all of that kind of thing. So it's been a very heavy sort of thing to get out of. I am not my grandmother.
You were only three.
Three and a half.
When
yeah.
she took her own life.
Tiny,
so,
but
did it have an impact nevertheless?
Oh, the memory is so vivid. The colour of the bricks I was playing with, I was sitting on the floor, to the phone going off in the hall. My mother putting down, she always read the Times, putting down the Times, going out into the hall, and then this terrible, terrible bellowing sound, and then her eventually coming in with her face wet, just going, Edith, Edith. And it's as vivid as if it was yesterday.
Your mother died in 2016, and you wrote a blog 5 days after her death describing her gutsy response to the tragedies yeah. in her life. But one detail which was fascinating, I thought, was that she had indexed all your books.
Yes. We were very often estranged. It was a very difficult relationship because I both loved her very much and needed to get away from all this misery. But in the last 25 years, she was a professional indexer. I asked her to index some of my books.
and she was a superb indexer. She even won an award for Greek tragedy and the British Theatre. We could never be intimate, so we forged a weird intimacy through discussing semicolons and lemmata and subheadings and how you cite Acts of Parliament. It was a sort of coded intimacy. I miss her terribly. Right now I'm battling with an index. But because it was our only way of being intimate, because there was so much we had never been able to discuss.
It's a curious thing to have in common. I mean, because she could sort of psychoanalyse most books authors by the index they wrote.
Yes, she could. She would often say, I know that man's gay. And she was always right. Or I know that person hasn't had a child or whatever.
We talked about your first marriage ending and the unhappiness that prompted. But this next piece is about the happiness you then found.
Well, actually, the rest of the programme is about the happiness that I then found.
Some people might be listening and thinking...
Been making it, I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, this is going to come out as if I'm the most miserable person in world history. But, and in fact, a lot of my young adulthood was. But then we get 1991... And I met Richard Poynder, and we instantly realised that this was something extraordinary. One of the reasons was he had only discovered music, classical music. He was from a completely uncultured family, rich but uncultured. And he had watched all of Leonard Bernstein's famous educative shows. And then we discovered this extraordinary recording of the Emperor, Beethoven, E-flat major. And we fell in love, and we used to drive. I was living in Oxford, round and round Oxford Ring Road, honestly, late at night, playing this heroically, triumphantly joyful concerto, singing along without words at the top of our voices.
The third movement of Beethoven's Concerto for Piano and Orchestra No. 5, The Emperor, performed by Christian Zimmermann and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
It's extraordinary, as each wave of, we haven't quite finished but yet, there's one more triumphal, you know, ripple effect to go. He jumps higher and higher and you're actually terrified he's going to jump off the podium. It's Bernstein at his very, very best.
You're now based in the University of Durham, Edith Hall, which has founded the first PGCE in classics in decades.
Yes! Isn't that fantastic? This means that
people from the Northeast are being trained in the Northeast to go out and teach classics in schools in the Northeast. It's a glorious innovation.
And are you finding that children, I know you were in a school just recently, are you finding that they really turned on by the classics like you were?
Yes, though the important distinction is that it's almost impossible economically to get Latin and Greek into the state school system. There is no Greek at all. Perhaps one or two last year managed to do those Greek exams. And there's fewer than four figures doing Latin in state school. However, these wonderful courses called Classical Civilization and Ancient History do not require a trained classicist PGCE. You can be taught by an English literature person or a history person, modern languages, even physics. And we're having great success in expanding those in the state school sector because you don't have to hire a new teacher.
You have, of course, chosen Don Giovanni next.
I've had to go for the Commendatore scene from Don Giovanni. You can't not have Don Giovanni on a show like this if you love musical theatre. The combination of the story, the spectacle, the ghost, and one of the most extraordinary pieces of music ever written. But there's a personal reason. This is for my beloved stepdaughter, Frances. When I met my husband, Richard, he had this free gift of a daughter for me called Frances, who is six and utterly adorable. She loved Amadeus. We would watch Amadeus, the film, over and over and over again. She just loved it. She loved everything about Mozart farting under the piano to this incredible ending and being able me to say, why is he going to hell? And we say, because he's a bad guy. You know, there's something about the ethics of it. This guy embraces vice ethics, not virtue ethics. He does the exact opposite. But what music is this? Those slithering octaves and arpeggios and sort of some sort of dissonance going on for the voice of justice. I just love the simplicity of the ethics.
Thank you.
The extraordinary scene in Act II of Don Giovanni, where the Commendatore sends the offending Don Giovanni down into the fires of hell.
Francis Poinder out there, thank you for making me watch that over and over again with you.
Aceno Teco from Act II of Mozart's Don Giovanni, from the Amadeus film soundtrack of 1984, where Richard Stillwell was Don Giovanni, Willard White, Leporello, and John Tomlinson, the Commendatore, with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. You've campaigned for the return of the Elgin Marbles, haven't you?
I'm a very proud member of the British Committee for the Reunification of what I want to call the Parthenon sculptures. Marbles implies these unworked chunks of something. I feel very, very passionately about it. And I think since the opening of the Acropolis Museum, specially designed, specially air heat controlled, since the opening, there is no excuse. And I predict that it's in my lifetime they're going back. The young won't tolerate it. It just smells of 19th century paternalistic colonialism.
I like the fact that when you become really excited about a subject, your family probably say you can't stop the beat, but that's what you've chosen next, isn't
it?
Oh,
yes. Well, Don Giovanni was for my stepdaughter, Fran. My two little girls thought classical music was ridiculous. They would impersonate what they thought a silly vibrato. They thought it was snobby. So I just decided I was going to take them to every musical there was. Don Giovanni was simply the most popular musical of the late 18th century. Hairspray, I remember, the end of Hairspray, them dancing at the theatre with me. And it's about end of racism, end of sexism. You can't stop us. History is moving on. Your history. And aren't we having a good time?
Keep spinning. can't stop my happiness, 'cause I like the way I am. And you just can't stop my knife and fork when I see a Christmas ham. So if you don't like the way I look, well, I just don't give a damn. 'Cause the world keeps spinning round and round, and my heart's keeping time to the speed of sound. I was lost till I heard the guns, till I found my way. 'Cause you can't stop the beat ever since this old world began. A woman found that if she shook, she could shake up a man. And so I'm gonna shake and shimmy at the best that I can today. 'Cause you can't stop the motion of the ocean or the sun in the sky. You can wonder if you wanna, but I never ask why. And if you try to pull me down, I'm gonna spit in your eye and say that you can't stop the beat.
You Can't Stop the Beat, performed by the motion picture cast of the film of Hairspray, written by Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman.
I love the fact that that very cast nicknamed it You Can't Stop to Breathe. And you, you have to listen to it to know what they meant.
Yeah. Now, we had to finish with something that had a strong connection to the Greeks and mythology. What is it?
The myth of Orpheus has, of course, played an absolutely seminal role in the development of opera and musical theatre since Monteverdi. But for me, it's a much more personal story. My mother heard me singing this when I was a little girl. I remember her saying, "Where did you hear that?" Now, she actually sang it when she was gardening. She may not have realised that. But Janet Baker was everywhere. And after I'd done this research journey about my maternal ancestors, and indeed written all of the book except the epilogue, I had a dream when my mother, who had previously, since she died, only appeared to me very distressed, so behind bars, behind dirty windows, she was beaming in the sunshine and singing this aria. Like, I know you've missed me, I know I've gone, but this music will comfort you. And she has never appeared to me menacingly as a fury in a dream again. So this has very much healed me, this particular aria. And it's, I have lost Eurydice, I do not know what to do. But somehow Gluck sees that this moment of grief is how art can transcend pain, that we can actually go to another level if we crystallise emotion into art. It is incredible. And I think I will need this played at my funeral.
Edith Hall, thank you very much.
Senza il mio ben, chi farò
Pharaoh's Senza e Euridice, composed by Christoph Gluck and performed by the countertenor Philippe Jaruski, the I Barocchisti Ensemble, and directed by Diego Fasolis. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the American writer Percival Everett. Edith Hall will be back to introduce tonight's Drama on Three, a production of Shakespeare's Cymbeline with Michael Maloney in the title role. The play's been adapted for radio and is directed by Emma Harding. Cymbeline is at 8 o'clock this evening here on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and from BBC Radio 4, this is a brand new series of history's secret heroes.
Raymond had only one thing on his mind, to fight the Nazis.
10 remarkable stories from World War II of individuals not to be underestimated. We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains in minus 40 degrees.
United by a spirit of defiance.
They knew these dangers, but still they carried on.
The new series of History's Secret Heroes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's 1:30 and you're listening to BBC Radio 3. In 90 minutes, this week's choral evensong is from Magdalen College, Oxford. But before then, time for our musical travelogue. To take us on the journey, here's Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to today's Music Map on BBC Radio 3, wending our way towards this sweeping fantasia. The music is by Ralph Vaughan Williams, and the piece it's based on, which we'll hear a bit later on, is a stark psalm setting by Thomas Tallis. As we map this iconic piece of music for strings, we'll be listening to jazz, classical nocturnes, folk song fantasies, and works stretching back to the Renaissance. But let's start with another fantasia by Vaughan Williams himself, based on another ancient English melody.